A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
We have a special prompt today from a listener named Sam Tucklebottom, data input specialist from Beit Shemesh. Sam's asking about the unspoken playbook of introducing yourself to new neighbors when you're renting. The core tension is this: in a volatile rental market where tenants come and go, how much do you invest in neighborly relations? Overinvest and your hallway becomes a social salon you can't escape. Underinvest and you're strategically isolated when you need something. There's also the ladder problem. You don't want to become the building's go-to hardware library. Sam's framing this as a delicate art, and honestly, there's a lot to unpack here.
The ladder problem. I love that this is where we're starting. There's a sociological concept called neighboring as a distinct category from friendship. Neighboring is proximity-based, non-voluntary, and operates on what researchers call friendly distance. Too close, you lose autonomy. Too distant, you lose the mutual aid network. The ladder is the perfect symbol of this.
The ladder is the perfect symbol of many things, Herman. It's the physical manifestation of, I now have a relationship with you that includes my tools. You lend a ladder once, you're the ladder person. You lend a drill. Suddenly, you're the hardware store with no closing hours.
Emily Post's Institute recommends introducing yourself within the first week, keeping it brief, exchanging phone numbers for emergencies, and not overwhelming new neighbors with invitations. The key phrase is cordial, but not intrusive. Sam's question is really about what that means when the ground keeps shifting under your feet.
Let's sit with that first week window. You're hauling boxes. You're sweaty. And yet, this is supposedly the optimal moment to define your social positioning for the next year, or possibly 3 months. Do you introduce yourself when you're at your worst, or wait until you've showered and missed the authenticity window?
The authenticity window. Some etiquette sources say yes, introduce yourself during the move-in chaos because it's low pressure. Others say wait until you're settled, bring a small something. The Israeli context complicates this because the move-in chaos here is a specific kind of chaos. The concept of privacy in Israeli apartment buildings is, let's say, theoretical.
The move-in is a public event whether you want it to be or not. Neighbors will assess your furniture, your family size, your general vibe, all while you're angling a couch through a stairwell designed for smaller furniture and possibly smaller humans. The question isn't whether you'll be observed, it's whether you'll control the narrative.
This is the first unspoken rule. Control the introductory moment before it controls you. If you don't introduce yourself, you'll still be introduced, just by other neighbors, without your input. The new people on the third floor, I saw them moving in a lot of IKEA boxes. That becomes your identity. You're the IKEA people now.
The less benign version is, they moved in at 11 p.m. and made a lot of noise. Now you're the noisy people. You haven't spoken to anyone, and you already have a reputation. So rule one, preempt the narrative. Be boring on purpose. Which brings us to the real strategic question. How boring should you be?
This is where Sam's insight about strategic opacity comes in. The playbook is about calibrated disclosure. You want to be pleasant enough that people will take a package for you or tell you if the water's being shut off, but not so interesting that people want to linger in the hallway. It's the friendly nod, not the dinner invitation.
The friendly nod, not the dinner invitation. Let's get concrete. You knock on the door. They open it. What's the script?
The consensus script is roughly, "Hi, I'm Name. I just moved in next door. Just wanted to introduce myself." Then you let them respond. You don't launch into your life story. You don't immediately ask for anything. You're signaling availability without demanding engagement. If they want to chat, they'll chat. If they give you a quick welcome, you take the hint and leave.
The bringing something question. Some people swear by a small plant or baked goods. Others say it creates an obligation. Now they have to return the Tupperware. You've manufactured a second interaction they may not want.
The Tupperware obligation is real. The consensus, if you bring something, make it consumable and in disposable packaging. The gift is a social signal. I'm the kind of person who brings things, not a logistical burden. In Israel, baked goods might read as warm. It could also read as trying too hard, depending on the building.
A homemade rugelach says, I'm a mensch. A store-bought pastry says, I remembered this existed on the way home. A plant says, I've given you a living thing to keep alive, and if it dies, you'll feel guilty every time you see me. Don't bring plants.
Don't bring plants. But let's go deeper on Sam's actual dilemma, the sustained relationship management under conditions of radical uncertainty. The lease is up in 8 months, or the landlord might sell. You don't know if the person you're being friendly with today will be your neighbor next year.
Most neighbor advice assumes stability. You buy a house, you're there for years. The rental calculus is fundamentally different. You're making relationship investments with an unknown time horizon. It's like dating someone who might move to another country next month. How much do you emotionally furnish that relationship?
The Israeli rental market makes this acute. The Bank of Israel reported rental prices rose about 7% year over year in early 2025, and turnover in cities like Jerusalem is high. The average rental duration in some neighborhoods is under 2 years. Sam's not describing a hypothetical.
Under 2 years. You're essentially in a co-working space, but for your living situation. The social norms haven't caught up. We're still operating on a model where neighbors are quasi-permanent fixtures, but the actual conditions make those relationships inherently provisional.
Which creates the hallway ambiguity problem. You see the same person 3 times a week. You've exchanged names. Are you now obligated to stop and chat every time? What's the decay rate on hallway acknowledgement? If you see them carrying groceries, do you offer to help? Or does that escalate the relationship to a level you're not prepared to maintain?
The decay rate on hallway acknowledgement. Let's break this down. I think there are tiers of neighbor relations. Tier 1 is the nod. Brief eye contact, maybe Shabbat Shalom, keep moving. This establishes you as a normal, non-hostile presence without creating obligations.
Tier 2 is the brief exchange. Weather, building issues, did you get the notice about the water shutoff? 30 seconds max. Still standing, no invitation to continue. This is the professional networking of apartment living.
Tier 3 is where it gets dangerous. The actual conversation. You've stopped walking. Topics have expanded beyond the building. This is where the ladder request becomes possible.
Tier 4 is the home visit. You've shared a meal, or at least a coffee. You're now closer to friends who happen to live adjacent. This is the tier Sam seems most cautious about, because Tier 4 is hard to downgrade. If you've had dinner and then your lease isn't renewed, you now have a friendship severed from its geographic foundation. Many don't.
If you want to downgrade from Tier 4 back to Tier 2 while still in the building, you can't unhave dinner. You can't unknow that their cat has a medical condition. The hallway has become a social salon, wanted or unwanted.
The playbook is about maintaining Tier 2 as the default, with strategic excursions to Tier 3 only when the cost-benefit analysis supports it. Tier 4 is reserved for neighbors who have demonstrated long-term stability, discretion, and a low likelihood of becoming a burden.
How do you vet a neighbor without them knowing they're being vetted? You can't hand them a questionnaire.
First signal, how they talk about other neighbors. If they're giving you detailed information about apartment 4 within your first conversation, that's a red flag. Whatever they tell you about others, they'll tell others about you.
Signal 2, how they respond to boundaries. If you give them the Tier 2 treatment, do they accept it or try to escalate? The neighbor who matches your energy is gold.
Signal 3, what they ask for and how early. If someone you've known for 3 days asks to borrow something, they see neighbor relations as transactional from the jump. If they ask for a ride to the airport in the first month, you're being sized up as a resource.
This is where the ladder problem connects. The ladder is a test. If you lend it easily, you've signaled that you're a lender. The next request might be bigger. The ladder is the gateway tool.
There's a term for this in social psychology, the foot-in-the-door technique. Small requests first, then escalating. Once you've established yourself as helpful, it's harder to say no. So the anti-ladder strategy is to be selectively unhelpful early, in ways that don't seem unfriendly, but do make you seem unreliable for certain requests.
How do you say no to a neighbor without creating friction in a relationship you have to maintain daily?
The classic technique is the vague, non-committal response with a redirect. Oh, I'm not sure where my ladder is right now, but I think there's a hardware store on Jaffa that rents them. You're not saying no. You're being helpful about not being helpful.
Another technique is the delayed response that never materializes. Let me check and get back to you. Most people won't follow up. This establishes you as someone with a slightly unreliable memory, which is a protective trait in a neighbor.
There's a risk. If you're too evasive, you become the unhelpful neighbor. Sam mentioned strategic isolation. If nobody talks to you, you don't hear about building issues, you don't get packages taken in. The playbook isn't about being antisocial. It's about being social in a calibrated way.
The goal is being the neighbor who's pleasant but slightly forgettable. The neighbor people wave at but don't think about much. Fine is the target.
Fine is the target. And fine requires maintenance. The holiday greeting. The brief acknowledgement of a new baby. The small gesture that says, I'm still here, I'm still normal, we're good.
Let's talk about the renovation acknowledgement. Your neighbor is renovating. There's noise. You're annoyed. But complaining too loudly makes you the difficult neighbor, and complaining too softly means the renovation drags on. What's the move?
The friendly inquiry disguised as concern. Hey, sounds like a big project. How's it going? When do you think it'll be done? You're not complaining. You're expressing interest. But you're also asking for a timeline, which creates subtle accountability. If it goes longer, you can reference that conversation.
That's elegant. And this is where Tier 2 relationships pay off. If you've maintained friendly distance, you can afford to be slightly more direct because you have social capital stored up. You haven't been asking for things. So when you do speak up, it carries weight.
Whereas if you're the neighbor who's always chatting, always having opinions, when you complain about noise, you're just adding to your existing profile as a high-maintenance presence. You've used up your social budget.
The social budget. Every neighbor interaction is either a deposit or a withdrawal. The nod is neutral. The brief exchange is a small deposit. Taking in a package is significant. Complaining is a withdrawal. The playbook is about maintaining a positive balance without over-contributing. You want to be in the black, but not so deeply that people think of you as the building's emotional ATM.
The building's emotional ATM. And Sam's insight about the volatile rental market complicates this. In a stable building, you can make long-term deposits knowing you'll be around to withdraw them. In a high-turnover building, you might make deposits you never get to use. The accounting breaks down.
Which means the rational strategy is to keep the balance sheet as close to zero as possible. Small deposits, small withdrawals, frequent reconciliation. This is emotionally counterintuitive because we're taught that being a good neighbor means being generous. But in an unstable environment, generosity can become a liability.
There's an asymmetry. The people most likely to ask for things, the ladder borrowers, the ride-needers, are often the people least likely to still be in the building when you need a return favor. The short-term renter has every incentive to extract value quickly because they won't face long-term social consequences.
It's the same dynamic as a tourist in a restaurant they'll never visit again versus a regular. The short-timer can afford to be a little more demanding. So one of the vetting questions is, how long have you been here? And how long are you planning to stay? You can't ask directly, but you can infer it from how they talk about their landlord or their last place.
Their time horizon shapes your investment strategy. The 5-year tenant is worth cultivating. The person on a 6-month sublet is not. This sounds mercenary, but it's rational allocation of social energy. You have finite hallway bandwidth. Spend it where it counts.
Let's talk about the crisis scenario. A pipe bursts. Someone's locked out. There's a security situation. In these moments, the social infrastructure you've built, or failed to build, becomes immediately relevant. This is the argument against total isolation. You can be the hermit on the 3rd floor for months, until you need someone to hold your baby while you deal with a flooding bathroom.
In Israel, some of these crisis scenarios have a particular character. Building security, shelter access during sirens, these aren't hypotheticals. There's a reason Israeli apartment buildings often develop intense micro-communities. The external environment pushes people together, but that same intensity can make the social dynamics more fraught.
Which brings us back to strategic opacity. In a building where information travels fast, what you don't reveal is as important as what you do. Your political views, your financial situation, your work schedule, all data points that can be used to make claims on your time. The more opaque you are, the fewer claims can be made.
There's a concept from sociologist Irving Goffman called civil inattention. It's the practice of acknowledging someone's presence while deliberately not engaging, the brief eye contact and then looking away. It signals, I see you, but I'm not going to intrude. Goffman argued this is a foundational social skill in dense urban environments. Without it, every interaction would be overwhelming.
That's the academic term for Sam's sweet spot. You see the neighbor, you register the neighbor, you don't pretend they don't exist. That would be hostile. But you also don't turn them into a conversation partner. You've performed the minimum social obligation and returned to your business.
You can do it with 20 neighbors. The problem is when someone doesn't accept civil inattention and pushes for more. That's when the playbook needs escalation protocols.
Let's map this out. Scenario 1. The hallway lingerer. You've done the nod. You're trying to move on. They keep talking. Protocol. Physical disengagement. Start moving toward your door mid-sentence. Well, good to see you. I've got to get going. Warm in tone, but immovable in action.
Scenario 2. The unexpected knock. Protocol. You don't have to answer. If you do, use the doorframe lean, body half in, half out, clearly not inviting them in. The conversation happens in the threshold. This maintains the territorial boundary.
Scenario 3. The oversharer. You've accidentally learned about their divorce, and now they expect emotional support. Protocol. The compassionate redirect. That sounds really difficult. I hope you have good people to talk to about it. You're acknowledging their pain while placing yourself outside their support network.
Scenario 4. The borrower. Protocol. The cheerful inability. Oh, I wish I could help, but I don't really lend things out. It's just a policy I have. You're stating a principle. It's harder to argue with a principle than a specific refusal.
It's just a policy I have. That's good. And it works best if you establish it early. If you lend the first time and refuse the second, that's a personal rejection. If you refuse the first time with a general policy, there's no rejection to take personally.
This is one of the most important principles in the whole playbook. The first interaction sets the template. If your first interaction is warm but brief, with clear boundaries, you've established a pattern that's easy to maintain. If it's an hour-long conversation where you offer to help with anything, unwinding that is nearly impossible.
The move-in introduction is disproportionately important. It's a precedent-setting event. You're defining the relationship parameters in the first 60 seconds. Most people don't think about this at all. They wing it.
Winging it is how you end up as the ladder person, or the cat sitter. The people who have these roles didn't choose them consciously. They fell into them through a series of small acquiescences that became expectations.
The acquiescence spiral. Say yes once, it's a favor. Twice, it's a pattern. Three times, it's your identity. Now saying no feels like a betrayal of who you've become in this building social ecosystem.
Which is why the playbook is a form of self-protection. It's about preserving your ability to choose. Every yes should be intentional, not automatic.
Let me share something from my own experience. Before I was domesticated, before I lived with humans in apartment buildings, I had a very different approach to neighboring. When you live in a tree, your neighbors are mostly other sloths, some birds, the occasional howler monkey. The relationships are simple. You don't borrow things. You don't have hallway interactions. You just exist in proximity. Moving into human apartment buildings was a shock. Suddenly there were all these unspoken rules about when to talk, what to share, how to perform friendliness. It took me years to understand that most of it is theater.
You're saying that before you lived with humans, you lived in a tree, with other sloths. And the social dynamics were simpler because nobody had ladders to lend.
Sloths don't have ladders. We have claws, and we don't lend those out. But human neighboring is uniquely complicated because it combines physical proximity with social expectation in a way most animal neighboring doesn't. A bird doesn't worry about whether it's being friendly enough to the bird in the next nest.
I'm not sure the sloth-to-human comparison is entirely fair, given that sloths are famously solitary and sleep 15 hours a day. But I take your point. Human neighboring is a constructed social practice, not a natural one. And because it's constructed, it varies by culture, by building type, by era. The playbook Sam's asking about is specific to a particular context. Israeli renters in multi-unit buildings in a volatile market.
The Israeli context matters. Israeli culture tends toward the direct and the familiar. People will ask personal questions considered inappropriate elsewhere. What counts as oversharing in London might be normal small talk in Jerusalem. And what counts as friendly in Jerusalem might be intrusive in Tokyo.
There's also the religious dimension. In religious neighborhoods, neighbor relations often operate on a different logic. Shabbat meals, synagogue communities, shared religious obligations. The playbook for a secular building in Tel Aviv is different from the playbook for a religious building in Beit Shemesh, which is where Sam lives.
Beit Shemesh is an interesting case. A mix of religious and secular populations. Different neighborhoods with different norms. A rental market under pressure. How you dress, whether you're observant, what you do on Shabbat, these become part of the neighbor calculus in ways they wouldn't in a more homogeneous building.
Let's go back to something Sam mentioned that we haven't fully unpacked. The idea that opacity is strategically useful. This is counterintuitive because we're often told authenticity and openness are virtues. But Sam's arguing that in neighbor relations, opacity is a tool.
Opacity is a tool because information is currency. If neighbors know your schedule, they know when to ask for things. If they know your skills, they know what requests to make. The less they know, the fewer claims they can make. But you have to manage it carefully. If you're completely opaque, you become the mysterious neighbor, which is its own kind of attention. You want to be unremarkably opaque, the kind where people don't even notice they don't know things about you.
It's the difference between, I wonder what he does all day, and not wondering at all. You're not hiding, you're just not highlighting.
This connects to the ladder problem directly. If people don't know you have a ladder, they can't ask to borrow it. The ladder exists in your apartment, not in the public knowledge of the building.
There's a tension with the crisis scenario. In a crisis, you want people to know things, that you're a doctor, that you have emergency supplies. The opacity that protects you in normal times can isolate you in emergencies.
The solution is selective disclosure at the right moments. You don't lead with, I'm a doctor. But if there's a medical emergency, you can reveal it then. The disclosure is event-driven, not identity-driven. You're a doctor when someone needs a doctor. You have a ladder when someone genuinely needs one in an emergency. You're not the ladder person, but you're also not the person who watches someone struggle while hiding a ladder behind your back.
The difference between being a resource and being a resource that's perpetually on call. The first is generous. The second is exhausting.
Let's talk about the departing neighbor. You've maintained a perfect tier 2 relationship for 2 years, and now they're moving out. What's the protocol?
The departing neighbor is the final exam. If you've managed the relationship well, the departure is simple. You wish them well. You say, keep in touch, without meaning it, and they say, you too, without meaning it. The relationship was always location dependent, and now the location is changing.
If you become actual friends, now the departure is a genuine loss. There's talk of staying in touch, and maybe you do for a few months, and then the text gets sparser. You've lost someone you cared about, which is the risk of tier 4 relationships in a rental context. The building takes them away.
This is the emotional cost of the playbook. The reason people overinvest despite the risks is that human beings crave connection. The playbook is a defense mechanism against a structural problem, the instability of rental housing. But it comes at the cost of genuine community formation. You can't have deep, trusting neighbor relationships and also protect yourself from the pain of those relationships ending.
That's the trade-off. The playbook optimizes for emotional safety and practical autonomy. It sacrifices depth for stability. For many renters, that's the right call. The alternative is a series of meaningful connections severed every year or two, which is its own kind of exhausting. But it's worth acknowledging what's being sacrificed.
Sam's prompt doesn't dwell on this, but the deeper question is, how do I live in a system that makes stable relationships impossible? The playbook is a coping mechanism for a structural failure. In a world where people owned their homes and stayed for decades, you'd invest more. The opacity wouldn't be necessary.
We live in a world of tenancy at will, rising rents, and constant turnover. In that world, Sam's playbook is adaptive. It's not the way humans are meant to live. I say this as someone who lived in a tree, but it's the way many humans do live, and having a conscious strategy is better than stumbling through blindly.
I want to add one more element, the role of shared spaces. In Israeli apartment buildings, the stairwell is the main theater, but there are also building committees, shared gardens, laundry rooms, bomb shelters. Each has its own social dynamics. The stairwell is for brief encounters. The building committee meeting is for structured negotiation. The shelter during an emergency is for collective action. Part of the playbook is knowing which space you're in and adjusting accordingly.
The shelter is a special case. During a siren, everyone's in the same room, often in various states of dress, often with scared children. The normal boundaries collapse. You see your neighbors as they actually are. Tired, anxious, human. Those moments can accelerate relationships faster than months of stairwell nods. A single night in the shelter can undo years of carefully maintained distance.
You can't really prevent that. The playbook isn't about avoiding all human connection. It's about managing connection in normal times. Emergencies are exceptions. You can be strategically opaque in March and warm in August when the sirens go off, and people will understand those are different contexts.
The context-dependent neighbor. That's the most sophisticated version of the playbook. You're not a fixed personality. In the hallway, you're brief. In the shelter, you're present. In the building meeting, you're practical. You're playing different roles in different spaces, and that's not inauthentic. It's adaptive.
I think that's a good place to land. Sam's prompt identifies a real tension, how to be neighborly without being consumed by neighborliness. And the answer isn't a single strategy, but a flexible repertoire. Know your tiers. Manage your first impression. Be selectively opaque. Maintain civil inattention as your default, and recognize when the situation demands something different.
Don't lend the ladder, unless there's an emergency. Then lend the ladder, but make it clear it's an exception. I don't normally do this, but given the circumstances, you've helped, and you've reinforced the boundary at the same time.
The Exceptional Ladder. That's the title of the episode, I think.
The Exceptional Ladder. I'd listen to that podcast.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1930s, the blood of horseshoe crabs was discovered to be exquisitely sensitive to bacterial contamination. 1 gallon of horseshoe crab blood was worth approximately $60,000 in today's currency, making it, ounce for ounce, roughly 15 times more valuable than crude oil at the time.
Right. So to wrap this up, the question Sam's prompt leaves me with is whether the playbook changes if the rental market ever stabilizes. If tenancy at will gets reformed, if rents stop spiking, if people can plan to stay somewhere for 5 or 10 years, does the calculus shift? Do we all become tier 4 neighbors again? Or have we gotten so used to the opacity strategy that we've forgotten how to be any other way?
I think that's the open question. The playbook is a response to conditions. Change the conditions, and the playbook might change too. But for now, Sam's described something real and recognizable, and I think a lot of renters will hear themselves in it. Thank you to Sam Tucklebottom for sending in this prompt. It's the kind of everyday strategic thinking that doesn't get enough attention.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com, and if you've got a prompt you'd like us to dig into, send it our way.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.